Our next guest is a surgeon who's dealt with end-of-life issues both as part of his profession and in his personal family life.
He says we need to re-examine a lot of the things we do in nursing homes and hospitals and in our families and change the focus from extending life at all costs to maintaining a good life until the very end.
Dr. Atul Gawande joins us now. He's a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, a professor at Harvard Medical School, and his latest book is Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End. He's speaking tonight at the Wisconsin Book Festival. That's at 7 p.m. at the Central Library in Madison. Dr. Gawande, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here.
Well, you write that despite your years of medical training, you felt like you were unready to help patients deal with the realities they faced through years of decline and mortality. What was missing?
It's interesting. We really aren't trained in how to understand and think about mortality in medical school. You'd think we would. You know, we got the cadaver to dissect. Mm-hmm. But we really focus on understanding disease and then what you can do about disease. And we're good at handling the fixables, but not the great unfixables. When I got into practice as a surgeon, I found that a large percentage of my time was spent with people who had problems I couldn't fix, chronic illness, frailty, and then terminal illness. And while I was really competent at knowing how to handle the first set of problems, the second ones, we often cause more suffering than anything else.
And you worried that too much of our attention was on those fixables and the health and extending our survival versus a broader concept of well-being. How do we make that transition?
Well, I think the place that it starts, and it came from really looking at people who are very good at handling these problems, whether they were oncologists, palliative care doctors, geriatricians, it started by their recognizing that people have goals for their care besides just living longer. They have priorities. Those might be that I want to be cognitively intact, or I want to be able to be home more than at the hospital. The second insight was that the most reliable way to find out what people's priorities are is to ask about them. And we don't ask.
And you go beyond simply healthcare and look at the ways we provide care for older people, especially people dealing with health issues, and you apply some of the same concepts there. Looking at things like nursing homes and some things that call themselves assisted care facilities, you cite a sociologist saying, you know, in a lot of ways we run these things like prisons.
It's totally true. Once you realize we're not asking people what their priorities are at the end of life, you start running up earlier along people's lives, and you realize we aren't asking them at any point where people are facing chronic impairment. So when you go in a nursing home, the priorities assume to be your health and your safety. But can you have a drink in a nursing home, you know, at night? No. Can you go out and see your friends? Nobody's prioritized that. You know, the priorities are around things like we don't want you to fall, but what about loneliness? What about helplessness? And you realize you're a patient and not a person. I looked at a place, for example, that instead of building the nursing home around the nursing station, you know, they all look like hospitals nowadays, they built it around a kitchen. And in the kitchen, you could go in the refrigerator and get whenever you wanted. You know how controversial that is?
Right. Yeah, I mean, from a medical perspective, people are thinking, you're going to let them handle knives. You're going to let them pick their own food. What about, there's a stove. There's a hot stove.
It might be unsafe. You know, a refrigerator, I mean, it could be that you have a diabetic taking a soda out of the refrigerator. How can we allow that? Or someone who has a medically ordered pureed diet, and they might steal a cookie. But you know what? 85-year-old, even with Alzheimer's, it's okay if they take the cookie. And we have to be able to understand people live for priorities bigger than just being alive.
And then how do we figure out that priority? So there's something more you're saying than living longer and avoiding a health condition that might, you know, hurt you, that might shorten your lifespan. How do we get to the core of that and define what a good life is, even as our health and maybe even our mental faculties are deteriorating?
Well, the key to it is that idea that we don't ask. And it turns out there's some skill that people have who are really good at asking. They ask certain kinds of questions. For example, instead of just giving you facts and figures about, you know, your survival rate and what might happen with this or that, they ask you, well, what's your understanding of your condition at this point in time? What are your fears and worries for the future? What are the goals you might have if your health worsens? And what are the outcomes that are unacceptable to you? When you understand what people are willing to sacrifice and what they're not willing to sacrifice, you get a picture of what matters to them, what they're really living for, and then you know where the bright lines are that you're not going to cross.
And finding meaning and finding a reason for being alive seems to be a key of a lot of what you write about. And you tell the story, among other people, of your own father as he left his profession. And you were worried about this. What does he do next? How did he start to find meaning above and beyond himself and above and beyond surviving?
He developed a brain tumor in his brainstem and spinal cord that was incurable, growing slowly. We knew it would claim his life. And I asked him those questions. I said, you know, what's your understanding of your condition? What are your hopes? What are your fears? And what he was able to articulate, we had this great conversation like we'd never had. I told him about a colleague's father who said, you know, if I can eat chocolate ice cream and watch football on television, that's good enough for me. Hmm. And my dad said, no way that's good enough for me. I want to be able to be socially interactive with people. And you know what was really important to him? He wanted to be able to Skype with family in India. He wanted to be able to email people. Well, you know, as long as we could preserve those capabilities, that guided us in many ways. You know, he took surgery, he underwent surgery when he lost the ability to do surgery himself, and that helped buy him more time without quadriplegia. Then radiation therapy made him worse instead of better, and when he had the oncology options, all the chemotherapy options laid out before him, we could measure them according to, are they going to take away his ability to be awake and interactive with people, to be able to, you know, Skype with his family back home? And the options, you know, his world was narrowing enough that those options were going to take it away. And he made the choice to enter hospice rather than take chemotherapy, and actually lived longer than expected by avoiding the toxicity of therapies that were pushing him further down the hill.
You had this conversation with your father as a son. You've had it with patients as a doctor. Which was harder for you?
No question that there are parts that were much harder being the son. I was afraid that my father would think the worst of me, when in fact he was more prepared than I ever expected to have that conversation. The hard part with the patient is the fear that they're going to think you're not competent. What do you mean that you're worried that I may not, that everything may not turn out for the best? Aren't you giving me the best options? And being able to ask these questions and understand that these questions are not about saying, you're going to die. It's about saying, what are we fighting for and what are we going to make sure we preserve along the way here? You know, one nurse put it to me that the goals that in medicine are often to sacrifice your time and quality of life now for the sake of possible time in the future. But as the chances of that possible time diminish and we sacrifice more and more of your life now, there are times when you start to ask, what if we ask for fighting for the best possible day today, regardless of what happens? What if we fight for making sure you are able to still do the things that are most important to you? And many people say that would be an amazing thing to still get to fight for.
We're talking to Dr. Atul Gawande about his new book, Being Mortal. He says we need to rethink the way we deal with the end of our lives, for ourselves, our families, our culture, and the medical profession.
And we want to hear from you. How has your own family dealt with the decline and death of a loved one? Looking back, would you have done things differently, geared more toward a good life in the moment rather than longevity? And if you're in the healthcare profession, what are you doing? What do you think we're doing right? And what are we doing wrong? What could we do better? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation in just a moment. You're listening to Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation with Dr. Atul Gawande. He is a surgeon, a Harvard Medical School professor, and the author of Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End.
You can join our conversation about the ways we deal with the end of life, from nursing homes to hospice care to medical treatment. Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Before we get to our callers, Dr. Gawande, one story you tell is about an experiment with pets at a nursing home.
Yeah, in upstate New York, a guy who calls himself a nursing home abolitionist named Bill Thomas was the nursing home director of a place where he said they have the three plagues of boredom, loneliness, and helplessness, and it depressed even him. And so he said this place needs life. And he said, what if we brought in pets? And not as like pets who could, you know, be managed by animal handlers, pets that could belong to the people who live there. And they went up against the New York State regulators and asked for a waiver from the rules. And he didn't just bring in a dog or two dogs. He brought in two dogs, four cats, and 100 birds.
Wow.
And they belonged to the people who lived there. So, you know, you could own your own cat. You could own your own pair of birds. And people, when they suddenly had responsibility, even an Alzheimer's patient could care for another being, they suddenly had purpose that they could live for. People came out of their shells, but they talked more. Their use of medications declined for psychosis, for anxiety. Their levels of satisfaction rose, and they actually lived longer. Now, the nursing home would have said, well, I was keeping them safe. But here, they were not tending to their purpose until they started to bring these elements in. And, you know, we'd take for granted that you go into a place like that, well, you can't have your pets anymore. But it's heartbreaking for people.
So, again, it's maybe not so much the pets themselves, but the humanity, the human expression that they brought out in the people.
Yeah. You know, what people have are loyalties. You know, it was a 19th century philosopher that I wrote about named Josiah Royce, who talked about the idea that intrinsic to people's lives is not just being healthy and safe, and that we're living in a time when no matter how old you were always at risk of death. And so what he was raising is, why is it unsatisfying just to be alive and safe? And the answer was, he said, was because we live for some ideals that are bigger than us, that we're willing to sacrifice our health and safety for. That might be for our children. It might be for our country. It might be for God. It might be for a pet. And the chance to care for and give of ourselves is something we need throughout our lives, even when we can be cognitively impaired.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Tim on the line in Eau Claire. Tim, hi.
Hi. I had a similar kind of situation. I was a satellite installer for years, and I had a customer's wife give me all of the gentleman's cigars and told me not to smoke, but gave them to me because he was dying of lung cancer and shouldn't be smoking anymore. He was stage 3 lung cancer, well into his 90s. I want to say he was 97. And I found a box of pre-embargo Cuban cigars. I put them in his boat. I called him. I told him where they were. Because to me, you don't get rid of your vices when you're 97 years old and dying of lung cancer.
It's a fascinating thing. I'm glad you bring this up. You know, if health and safety are the preeminent, I write about my wife's grandmother who went into a nursing home and they took away things that were really important to her. You know, the particular foods that she loved because they weren't necessarily safe. The chance for a drink at night. The because it wasn't always the healthiest thing to do. But the chance to make these choices, you know, an 85-year-old with Alzheimer's who's told you can't have cookies anymore because you have to be on a pureed diet. And what did you see? Most commonly, people get written up for violating the food rules or violating the smoking rules. But when you're 85 years old with Alzheimer's and you're stealing cookies, like, let him have the damn cookies or let him have that cigar at that point in his life, or at least let him make the choices to be able to do so. It is out of a recognition that, you know, I'm going to argue with my patients to say you shouldn't smoke and you should put on your seatbelt. But I'm also not going to put him in a prison which says you have no choices whatsoever. You have no ability to balance the risks. And these are places across the country now that have, there are many of these places that have found ways to allow people to take risks without ending up with malpractice suits or an inability to make these places work. And in fact, those places have equal or better survival as a result.
Tim, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to George in Milwaukee next. George, hi.
Hi. You know, similar to the guest, I had my dad was in a health decline for several years, and you know, although his situation was very challenging physically, he was able to participate over a 4-year period in the birth of two of my sons, and you know, looking back now, I can't imagine that he wouldn't have been around during that period, but. What really resonated with me was the whole highly subjective nature of quality of life. And if the guest could please share his perspectives on how he's seen different patients define that.
It is highly different from person to person. There are some common elements. Most people want to be connected to people who know them and love them. And they're living in places that don't necessarily foster those kinds of relationships. They don't ask, how do we keep you connected to people that you are close to? You know, when you go in a nursing home, you're suddenly cut off from the outside world, and that's not being sustained. Another common element is almost everybody has something larger than themselves that they're living for, and that differs from person to person, whether it's, as I mentioned, you know, political campaigns or certain ideals or just their children or the country. And making ways that they can be connected to those larger goals are really important. Now, there is that subset who become cognitively impaired, but even they are expressing themselves all the time. I tell the story of Ruth Barrett, lived in a low-income housing facility run by this amazing woman in northern Massachusetts who said, I'm going to keep them in their homes and let them make choices, even though she was with severe Alzheimer's disease, had lost the last 30 years of her life, was in a wheelchair. Well, she was expressing every day that what she loved to do was be with people, and she loved to eat, and there was no bigger joy for her than going out to a restaurant. And so they arranged once a week, she could go out with her friends. She always loved to go to TGI Fridays. They went to TGI Fridays. She'd order a margarita against all the rules and hang out with her friends. They'd triple up on the Depends and they'd make it happen. And it didn't cost more money. It just meant that they shifted their priorities about time. They didn't make priorities for bingo and very passive group entertainment. They made priorities for kind of unscheduled, spontaneous time, which is the kind we all live and have.
Well, as we wrap up, are we as a culture and maybe the medical profession also shifting our priorities? Are you seeing a change in our concept of the right way to reach the end of our lives?
I think we are. We are used to saying, you know, America's way behind the rest of the world. Honestly, I found in the research that much of the world, Europe has a similar, you know, we think it's very different, but over 65, about 25% or so of our health spending here and abroad is on the end of life. But there's a change underway right now. In the late 90s, more than 80% of us died in institutions behind curtains. Today, it's risen to more than 45% dying in hospice, with about half of those people being in hospice at home and half in hospice centers outside of hospitals and other healthcare institutions. We're all getting more experience with being around people who die and seeing that it could be something that has moments worth cherishing and that are really important to us, important for the meaning of our lives.
Dr. Gawande, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Atul Gawande, surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. His new book is Being Mortal, and he's speaking tonight at the Wisconsin Book Festival. That's 7 o'clock tonight at the Central Library in Madison.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.